Where the hell is he going?
Deborah muttered as she put down the radio. Maybe he's just driving around, I said. It's a beautiful night.
Uh-huh. You want to write a sonnet?
Under normal circumstances, I would have had a splendid comeback for that. But perhaps due to the thrilling nature of our chase, nothing occurred to me. And anyway, Debs looked like she could use a victory, however small. A few blocks later, Oscar suddenly accelerated into the left lane and turned left across oncoming traffic, raising an entire concerto of angry horns from drivers moving in both directions.
He's making a move, Deborah told Doakes, west on 135th Street.
I'm crossing behind you, Doakes said, on the broad causeway.
What's on 135th Street? Debs wondered aloud.
Opa-locka Airport, I said, a couple of miles straight ahead.
Shit, she said, and picked up the radio.
Doakes, Opa-locka Airport is out this way.
On my way, he said,
and I could hear his siren cutting on before his radio clicked off. Opa-locka Airport had long been popular with people in the drug trade, as well as with those in covert operations. This was a handy arrangement, considering that the line between the two was often quite blurry. Oscar could very easily have a small plane waiting there, ready to whisk him out of the country and off to almost any place in the Caribbean or Central or South America. With connections to the rest of the world, of course, although I doubted he would be headed for the Sudan, or even Beirut. Someplace in the Caribbean was more likely, but in any case, fleeing the country seemed like a reasonable move under the circumstances, and Opa-locka Airport was a logical place to start. Oscar was going a little faster now, although 135th Street was not as wide and well-traveled as Biscayne Boulevard. We came up over a small bridge across a canal, and as Oscar came down the far side, he suddenly accelerated, squealing through traffic around an S-curve in the road.
God damn it, something spooked him, Deborah said. He must have spotted us.
She sped up to stay with him, still keeping two or three cars back, even though there seemed little point now to be pretending we weren't following him. Something had indeed spooked him, because Oscar was driving wildly, dangerously close to slamming into the traffic or running up onto the sidewalk. And naturally enough, Debs was not going to let herself lose this kind of pissing contest. She stayed with him, swerving around cars that were still trying to recover from their encounters with Oscar. Just ahead, he swung into the far left lane, forcing an old Buick to spin away, hit the curb, and crash through a chain-link fence into the front yard of a light blue house. Would the sight of our little unmarked car be enough to cause Oscar to behave this way? It was nice to think so, and made me feel very important, but I didn't believe it. So far, he had acted in a cool and controlled way. If he wanted to ditch us, it seemed more likely that he would have made some kind of sudden and tricky move, like going over the drawbridge as it went up. So why had he suddenly panicked? Just for something to do, I leaned forward and looked into the side mirror. The block letters on the surface of the mirror told me that objects were closer than they appeared. Things being what they were, this was a very unhappy thought, because only one object appeared in the mirror at the moment. It was a battered white van. And it was following us, and following Oscar, matching our speed, moving in and out of traffic.
Well, I said, not stupid after all.
And I raised my voice to go over the squeal of tires and the horns of the other motorists.
Oh, Deborah, I said,
I don't want to distract you from your driving chores, but if you have a moment, could you look in your rearview mirror?
What the fuck is that supposed to mean? She snarled,
but she flicked her eyes to the mirror. It was a good piece of luck that we were on a straight stretch of road, because for just a second she almost forgot to steer.
Oh, shit, she whispered.
Yes, that's what I thought, I said. The I-95 overpass stretched across the road directly ahead, and just before he passed under it, Oscar swerved violently to the right, across three lanes, and turned down a side street that ran parallel to the freeway. Deborah swore and wrenched her car around to follow.
"Tell Doakes," she said, and I obediently picked up the radio.
"Sergeant Doakes," I said, "we are not alone." The radio hissed once.
"The fuck does that mean?"
Doakes said, almost as if he had heard Deborah's response and admired it so much he had to repeat it.
"We have just turned right on 6th Avenue, and we are being followed by a white van."
There was no answer, so I said again,
"Did I mention that the van is white?"
And this time I had the great satisfaction of hearing Doakes grunt,
"Motherfucker."
"That's exactly what we thought," I said. "Let the van in front, and stay with him," he said.
"No shit,"
Deborah muttered through clenched teeth, and then she said something much worse. I was tempted to say something similar, because as Doakes clicked off his radio, Oscar headed up the on-ramp onto I-95, with us following. And at the very last second, he yanked his car back down the paved slope and onto 6th Avenue. His Forerunner bounced as it hit the road and teetered drunkenly to the right for a moment, then accelerated and straightened up. Deborah hit the brakes, and we spun through half a turn. The white van slid ahead of us, bounced down the slope, and closed the gap with the Forerunner. After half a second, Deb straightened us out of our slide and followed them down onto the street. The side road here was narrow, with a row of houses on the right and a high yellow cement embankment on the left, with I-95 on top. We ran along for several blocks, picking up speed. A tiny old couple holding hands paused on the sidewalk to watch our strange parade rocket past. It may have been my imagination, but they seemed to flutter in the wind from Oscar's car and the van going by. We closed the gap just a little, and the white van closed on the Forerunner, too. But Oscar picked up the pace. He ran a stop sign, leaving us to veer around a pickup truck that was spinning in a circle in an attempt to avoid the Forerunner and the van. The truck wobbled through a clumsy donut turn and slammed into a fire hydrant. But Debs just clamped her jaw tight and squealed around the truck and through the intersection, ignoring the horns and the fountain of water from the ruptured hydrant and closing the gap again in the next block. Several blocks ahead of Oscar, I could see the red light of a major cross street. Even from this far, I could see a steady stream of traffic moving through the intersection. Of course, nobody lives forever, but this was really not the way I would choose to die, if given a vote. Watching TV with Rita suddenly seemed a lot more attractive. I tried to think of a polite but very convincing way to persuade Deborah to stop and smell the roses for a moment, but just when I needed it the most, my powerful brain seemed to shut down, and before I could get it going again, Oscar was approaching the traffic light. Quite possibly, Oscar had been to church this week, because the light turned green as he rocketed through the intersection. The white van followed close behind, braking hard to avoid a small blue car trying to beat the light. And then, it was our turn, with the light fully green now. We swerved around the van and almost made it through. But this was Miami, after all, and a cement truck ran the red light behind the blue car right in front of us. I swallowed hard as Deborah stood on the brake pedal and spun around the truck. We thumped hard against the curb, running the two left wheels up onto the sidewalk for just a moment before bouncing down onto the road again. "Very nice," I said as Deborah accelerated once again. And quite possibly, she might have taken the time to thank me for my compliment, if only the white van had not chosen that moment to take advantage of our slowdown to drop back beside our car and swerve into us. The rear end of our car slewed around to the left, but Deborah fought it back around again. The van popped us again, harder, right behind my door, and as I lurched away from the blow, the door sprung open. Our car swerved, and Deborah braked. Perhaps not the best strategy, since the van accelerated at the same moment, and this time clipped my door so hard that it came loose and bounced away, hitting the van a solid smack near the rear wheel before spinning off like a deformed wheel, spitting sparks.
I saw the van wobble slightly and heard the slack rattling sound of a blown tire. Then the wall of white smashed into us one more time. Our car bucked violently, lurched to the left, hopped the curb, and burst through a chain-link fence separating the side road from the ramp leading down off I-95. We twirled around as if the tires were made of butter. Deborah fought the wheel with her teeth showing, and we very nearly made it across the off-ramp. But of course, I had not been to church this week, and as our two front wheels hit the curb on the far side of the off-ramp, a large red SUV banged into our rear fender. We spun up onto the grassy area of the freeway intersection that surrounded a large pond. I had only a moment to notice that the cropped grass seemed to be switching places with the night sky. Then the car bounced hard, and the passenger airbag exploded into my face. It felt like I had been in a pillow fight with Mike Tyson. I was still stunned as the car flipped onto its roof, hit the pond, and began to fill with water.
This ends Disc 5. Dearly Devoted Dexter, Disc 6.
Chapter 20. I'm not shy about admitting my modest talents. For example, I am happy to admit that I am better than average at clever remarks, and I also have a flair for getting people to like me. But to be perfectly fair to myself, I am ever ready to confess my shortcomings, too. And a quick round of soul-searching forced me to admit that I had never been any good at all at breathing water. As I hung there from the seatbelt, dazed and watching the water pour in and swirl around my head, this began to seem like a very large character flaw. The last look I had at Deborah before the water closed over her head was not encouraging either. She was hanging from her seatbelt, unmoving, with her eyes closed and her mouth open, just the opposite of her usual state, which was probably not a good sign. And then the water flooded up around my eyes, and I could see nothing at all. I also like to think that I react well to the occasional unexpected emergency, so I'm quite sure my sudden stunned apathy was the result of being rattled around and then smacked with an airbag. In any case, I hung there upside down in the water for what seemed like quite a long time, and I am ashamed to admit that for the most part, I simply mourned my own passing. Dear departed Dexter, so much potential, so many dark fellow travelers still to dissect, and now so tragically cut short in his prime. Alas, dark passenger, I knew him well. And the poor boy was finally just about to get married, too. How more than sad. I pictured Rita in white, weeping at the altar, two small children wailing at her feet. Sweet little Aster, her hair done up in a bouffant bubble, a pale green bridesmaid dress now soaked with tears. And quiet Cody in his tiny tuxedo, staring at the back of the church and waiting, thinking of our last fishing trip and wondering when he would ever get to push the knife in again and twist it so slowly, watching the bright red blood burble out onto the blade and smiling, and then... Slow down, Dexter. Where did that thought come from? Rhetorical question, of course, and I didn't need the low rumble of amusement from my old interior friend to give me the answer. But with his prompting, I put together a few scattered pieces into half a puzzle and realized that Cody... Isn't it odd what we think about when we're dying? The car had settled onto its flattened roof, moving with no more than a gentle rocking now, and completely filled with water so thick and mucky that I couldn't have seen a flare gun firing from the end of my nose. And yet, I could see Cody perfectly clearly, more clearly now than the last time we had been in the same room together. And standing behind this sharp image of his small form towered a gigantic dark shadow, a black shape with no features that somehow seemed to be laughing. Could it be? I thought again about the way he had put the knife so happily into his fish.
I thought about his strange reaction to the neighbor's missing dog. Much like mine when I had been asked at the same age about a neighborhood dog I had taken and experimented with. And I remembered that he, too, had gone through a traumatic event like I had, when his biological father had attacked him and his sister in a terrifying drug-induced rage and beat them with a chair. It was a totally unthinkable thing to think, a ridiculous thought. But all the pieces were there. It made perfect poetic sense. I had a son, someone just like me. But there was no wise foster father to guide his first baby steps into the world of slice and dice. No all-seeing Harry to teach him how to be all he could be, to help him change from an aimless child with a random urge to kill into a caped avenger. No one to carefully and patiently steer him past the pitfalls and into the gleaming knife blade of the future. No one at all for Cody. Not if Dexter died here and now. It would sound far too melodramatic for me to say, "The thought spurred me to furious action." And I am only melodramatic on purpose, when there is an audience. However, as the realization of Cody's true nature hit me, I also heard, almost like an echo, a deep, unbodied voice saying, "Undo the seatbelt, Dexter." And somehow, I managed to make my suddenly huge and clumsy fingers move to the belt's lock and fumble with the release. It felt like trying to thread a needle with a ham, but I poked and pushed and finally felt something give. Of course, this meant that I bumped down onto the ceiling on my head, a little hard considering that I was underwater. But the shock of getting thumped on the head cleared away a few more cobwebs, and I righted myself and reached for the opening where the car's door had been knocked away. I managed to pull myself through and face first into several inches of muck on the bottom of the pond. I righted myself and kicked hard for the surface. It was a fairly feeble kick, but quite good enough since the water was only about 3 feet deep. The kick sent me shooting up to my knees and then staggering to my feet, and I stood there in the water for just a moment, retching and sucking in the wonderful air. A marvelous and underrated thing, air. How true it was that we never appreciate things until we must do without them. What a terrible thought to picture all the poor people of this world who must do without air. People like Deborah? A real human being might have thought of his drowning sister much sooner. But really, let's be fair. One can only expect so much from an imitation after what I had been through. And I did actually think of her now, possibly still in time to do something meaningful. But although I wasn't really reluctant to rush to the rescue, I couldn't help thinking that we were asking a bit much of dutifully dashing Dexter this evening, weren't we? No sooner out of it than I had to go right back in again. Still, family was family, and complaining had never done me a bit of good. I took a deep breath and slid back under the muddy water, feeling my way through the doorway and into the front seat of Deborah's topsy-turvy car. Something smacked me across the face and then grabbed me brutally by the hair. Deb's herself, I hoped, since anything else moving around in the water would surely have much sharper teeth. I reached up and tried to pry apart her fingers. It was hard enough to hold my breath and fumble around blindly without receiving an impromptu haircut at the same time. But Deborah held tight, which was a good sign, in a way, since it meant she was still alive. But it left me wondering whether my lungs or my scalp would give out first. This would never do. I put both my hands on the job and managed to pry her fingers away from my poor, tender hairdo. Then I followed her arm up to the shoulder and felt across her body until I found the strap of the seatbelt. I slid my hand down the strap to the buckle and pushed the release. Well, of course, it was jammed. I mean, we already knew it was one of those days, didn't we? It was one thing after another, and really, It would have been far too much to hope that even one small thing might go right. Just to underline the point, something went blurp in my ear, and I realized that Deborah had run out of time and was now trying her luck at breathing water. It was possible that she would be better at it than I was, but I didn't think so. I slid lower in the water and braced my knees against the roof of the car, wedging my shoulder against Deb's midsection and pushing up to take her weight off the seatbelt. Then I pulled as much slack as I could get down to the buckle and slid it through, making the belt very floppy and loose. I braced my feet and pulled Deborah through the belt and toward the door. She seemed a bit loose and floppy herself. Perhaps after all my valiant effort, I was too late. I squeezed through the door and pulled her after me. My shirt caught on something in the doorway and ripped, but I pulled myself through anyway, staggering upright once again into the night air. Deborah was dead weight in my arms, and a thin stream of mucky water dribbled from the corner of her mouth. I hoisted her onto my shoulder and sloshed through the muck to the grass. The muck fought back every step of the way, and I lost my left shoe before I got more than 3 steps from the car. But shoes are, after all, much easier to replace than sisters, so I soldiered on until I could climb up onto the grass and dump Deborah on her back on the solid earth. In the near distance, a siren wailed, and was almost immediately joined by another. Joy and bliss. Help was on the way. Perhaps they would even have a towel. In the meantime, I wasn't certain it would arrive in time to do Deborah any good, so I dropped down beside her, slung her face down over my knee, and forced out as much water as I could. Then I rolled her onto her back, cleared a fingerload of mud from her mouth, and began to give her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. At first, my only reward was another gout of mucky water, which did nothing to make the job more pleasant. But I kept at it, and soon Debs gave a convulsive shudder and vomited a great deal more water, most of it on me, unfortunately. She coughed horribly, took a breath that sounded like rusty door hinges swinging open, and said, "Fuck!" For once, I truly appreciated her hard-boiled elegance. "Welcome back," I said. Deborah rolled weakly onto her face and tried to push herself up onto her hands and knees, but she collapsed onto her face again, gasping with pain. "Oh, God! Oh, shit! Something's broken!" she moaned. She turned her head to the side and threw up a little more, arching her back and sucking in great ratcheting breaths in between spasms of nausea. I watched her, and I admit I felt a little pleased with myself. Dexter the diving duck had come through and saved the day. "Isn't throwing up great?" I asked her. "I mean, considering the alternative." Of course, a really biting reply was beyond the poor girl in her weakened condition, but I was pleased to see that she was strong enough to whisper, "Fuck you." "Where does it hurt?" I asked her. "God damn it," she said, sounding very weak. "I can't move my left arm. The whole arm." She broke off and tried to move the arm in question, and succeeded only in causing herself what looked like a great deal of pain. She hissed in a breath, which set her coughing weakly again, and then just flopped over onto her back and gasped. I knelt beside her and probed gently at the upper arm. "Here?" I asked her. She shook her head. I moved my hand up, over the shoulder joint and to the collarbone, and I didn't have to ask her if that was the place. She gasped, her eyes fluttered, and even through the mud on her face, I could see her turn several shades paler. "Your collarbone is broken," I said.
"It can't be," she said with a weak and raspy voice. "I have to find Kyle."
"No," I said. "You have to go to the emergency room. If you go stumbling around like this, you'll end up right next to him, all tied and taped, and that won't do anyone any good."
"I have to," she said.
"Deborah, I just pulled you out of an underwater car, ruining a very nice bowling shirt. Do you want to waste my perfectly good heroic rescue?
She coughed again and grunted from the pain of her collarbone as it moved with her spasmodic breathing. I could tell that she wasn't finished arguing yet, but it was starting to register with her that she was in a great deal of pain. And since our conversation was going nowhere, it was just as well that Doakes arrived, followed almost immediately by a pair of paramedics. The good sergeant looked hard at me, as if I had personally shoved the car into the pond and flipped it on its back.
"Lost 'em, huh?" he said,
which seemed terribly unfair. Yes, it turned out to be much harder than I thought to follow him when we were upside down and underwater. I said, "Next time you try that part, and we'll stand here and complain." Doakes just glared at me and grunted. Then he knelt beside Deborah and said, "You hurt?"
"Collarbone," she said. "It's broken."
The shock was wearing off rapidly, and she was fighting the pain by biting her lip and taking ragged breaths. I hoped the paramedics had something a little more effective for her. Doakes said nothing. He just lifted his glare up to me. Deborah reached out with her good arm and grabbed his arm.
"Doakes," she said, and he looked back at her. "Find him," she said.
He just watched her as she gritted her teeth and gasped through another wave of pain. "Coming through here," one of the paramedics said. He was a wiry young guy with a spiky haircut, and he and his older, thicker partner had maneuvered their gurney through the chain-link fence where Deb's car had torn a gap. Doakes tried to stand to let them get to Deborah, but she pulled on his arm with surprising strength.
"Find him," she said again.
Doakes just nodded, but it was enough for her. Deborah let go of his arm, and he stood up to give the paramedics room. They swooped in and gave Debs a once-over, and they moved her onto their gurney, raised it up, and began to wheel her toward the waiting ambulance. I watched her go, wondering what had happened to our dear friend in the white van. He had a flat tire. How far could he get? It seemed likely that he would try to switch to a different vehicle rather than stop and call AAA to help him change the tire. So somewhere nearby, we would be very likely to find the abandoned van and a missing car. Out of an impulse that seemed extremely generous, considering his attitude toward me, I moved over to tell Doakes my thoughts. But I only made it a step and a half in his direction when I heard a commotion coming our way. I turned to look. Running at us up the middle of the street was a chunky middle-aged guy in a pair of boxer shorts and nothing else. His belly hung over the band of his shorts and wobbled wildly as he came, and it was clear that he had not had much practice at running. And he made it harder on himself by waving his arms around over his head and shouting, "Hey! Hey! Hey!" as he ran. By the time he crossed the ramp from I-95 and got to us, he was breathless, gasping too hard to say anything coherent. But I had a pretty good idea what he wanted to say.
"Debang!"
he gasped out, and I realized that his breathlessness and his Cuban accent had combined, and he was trying to say, "the van."
"A white van? With a flat tire? And your car is gone?"
I said, and Doakes looked at me. But the gasping man was shaking his head.
"White van, sure. I hear I thought it's a dog inside, maybe hurt," he said,
and paused to breathe deeply so he could properly convey the full horror of what he had seen.
"And then..."
But he was wasting his precious breath. Doakes and I were already sprinting up the street in the direction he had come from. Chapter 21. Sergeant Doakes apparently forgot he was supposed to be following me because he beat me to the van by a good 20 yards. Of course, he had the very large advantage of having both shoes, but still, he moved quite well. The van was run up on the sidewalk in front of a pale orange house surrounded by a coral rock wall. The front bumper had thumped a rock corner post and toppled it, and the rear of the vehicle was skewed around to face the street so we could see the bright yellow of the Choose Life license plate. By the time I caught up with Doakes, he already had the rear door open, and I heard the mewling noise coming from inside. It really didn't sound quite so much like a dog this time, or maybe I was just getting used to it. It was a slightly higher pitch than before, and a little bit choppier. More of a shrill gurgle than a yodel, but still recognizable as the call of one of the living dead. It was strapped to a backless car seat that had been turned sideways, so it ran the length of the interior. The eyes in their lidless sockets were rolling wildly back and forth, up and down, and the lipless, toothless mouth was frozen into a round O, and it was squirming the way a baby squirms, but without arms and legs, it couldn't manage any significant movement. Doakes was crouched over it, looking down at the remainder of its face with an intense lack of expression. "Frank," he said, and the thing rolled its eyes to him. The yowling paused for just a moment, and then resumed on a higher note, keening with a new agony that seemed to be begging for something. "You recognize this one?" I asked. Doakes nodded. "Frank Aubrey," he said. "How can you tell?" I asked. "Because really, you would think that all former humans in this condition would be awfully hard to tell apart. The only distinguishing mark I could see was forehead wrinkles." Doakes kept looking at it, but he grunted once and nodded at the side of the neck. "Tattoo. It's Frank." He grunted again, leaning forward and flicking a small piece of notepaper taped to the bench. I leaned in for a look. In the same spidery hand I had seen before, Dr. Danko had written, "Honor." "Get the paramedics," Doakes said. I hurried over to where they were just closing the back doors of the ambulance. "Do you have room for one more?" I asked. "He won't take up a lot of space, but he'll need heavy sedation." "What kind of condition is he in?" the spike-haired one asked me. It was a very good question for someone in his profession to ask, but the only answers that occurred to me seemed a little flippant, so I just said, "I think you may want heavy sedation, too." They looked at me like they thought I was kidding, and didn't really appreciate the seriousness of the situation. Then they looked at each other and shrugged.
"Okay, pal," the older one said. "We'll squeeze him in."
The spike-haired paramedic shook his head, but he turned and opened the back door of the ambulance again and began pulling out the gurney. As they wheeled down the block to Danko's crashed van, I climbed in the back of the ambulance to see how Debs was doing. Her eyes were closed and she was very pale, but she seemed to be breathing easier. She opened one eye and looked at me.
"We're not moving," she said.
"Dr. Danko crashed his van." She tensed and tried to sit up, both eyes wide open.
"You got him?"
"No, Debs. Just his passenger. I think he was about to deliver it because it's all done." I had thought she was pale before, but she almost vanished now.
"Kyle?" she said.
"No," I told her. "Doakes says it's someone named Frank."
"Are you sure?"
"Apparently positive. There's a tattoo on his neck."
"It's not Kyle, sis."
Deborah closed her eyes and drifted back down onto the cot, as if she was a deflating balloon.
"Thank God," she said.
"I hope you don't mind sharing your cab with Frank," I said. She shook her head.
"I don't mind," she said,
and then her eyes opened again.
"Dexter, no fucking around with Doakes. Help him find Kyle. Please?"
It must have been the drugs working on her, because I could count on one finger the number of times I had heard her ask anything so plaintively.
"All right, Debs. I'll do my best," I said,
and her eyes fluttered closed again.
"Thanks," she said.
I got back to Danko's van just in time to see the older paramedic straighten up from where he had obviously been vomiting, and turned to talk to his partner, who was sitting on the curb, mumbling to himself over the sounds that Frank was still making.
"Come on, Michael," the older guy said. "Come on, buddy."
Michael didn't seem interested in moving, except for rocking back and forth as he repeated, "Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. Oh, God."
I decided he probably didn't need my encouragement, and I went around to the driver's door of the van. It was sprung open, and I peeked in. Dr. Danko must have been in a hurry, because he had left behind a very pricey-looking scanner, the kind that police groupies and news hounds use to monitor emergency radio traffic. It was very comforting to know that Danko had been tracking us with this, and not some kind of magic powers. Other than that, the van was clean. There was no telltale matchbook, no slip of paper with an address or a cryptic word in Latin scribbled on the back. Nothing at all that could give us any kind of clue. There might turn out to be fingerprints, but since we already knew who had been driving, that didn't seem very helpful. I picked up the scanner and walked around to the rear of the van. Doakes was standing beside the open back door as the older paramedic finally got his partner onto his feet. I handed Doakes the scanner. "It was in the front seat," I said. "He's been listening." Doakes just glanced at it and put it down inside the back door of the van. Since he didn't seem terribly chatty, I asked, "Do you have any ideas about what we should do next?" He looked at me and didn't say anything, and I looked back expectantly. I suppose we could have stood like that until the pigeons began to nest on our heads, if it hadn't been for the paramedics.
"Okay, guys," the senior one said, and we moved aside to let them get to Frank.
The stocky paramedic seemed to be perfectly all right now, as if he was here to put a splint on a boy with a twisted ankle. His partner still looked quite unhappy, however, and even from 6 feet away, I could hear his breathing. I stood beside Doakes and watched them slide Frank onto the gurney and then wheel him away. When I looked back at Doakes, he was staring at me again. Once more, he gave me his very unpleasant smile.
"Down to you and me," he said, "and I don't know about you."
He leaned against the battered white van and crossed his arms. I heard the paramedic slam the ambulance door, and a moment later, the siren started up.
"Just you and me," Doakes said again, "and no more referee."
"Is this more of your simple country wisdom?" I said. Because here I was, having sacrificed an entire left shoe and a very nice bowling shirt, to say nothing of my hobby, Deborah's collarbone, and a perfectly good motor pool car. And there he stood, without so much as a wrinkle in his shirt, making cryptically hostile remarks. Really, the man was too much.
"Don't trust you," he said.
I thought it was a very good sign that Sergeant Doakes was opening up to me by sharing his doubts and feelings. Still, I felt like I should try to keep him focused. "That doesn't matter. We're running out of time," I said. "With Frank finished and delivered, Danko will start on Kyle now." He cocked his head to one side and then shook it slowly.
"Don't matter about Kyle," he said. "Kyle knew what he was getting into. What matters is catching the doctor."
"Kyle matters to my sister," I said. "That's the only reason I'm here." Doakes nodded again.
"Pretty good," he said. "Could almost believe that."
For some reason, it was then that I had an idea. I admit that Doakes was monumentally irritating, and it wasn't just because he had kept me from my important personal research, although that was clearly bad enough. But now he was even critiquing my acting, which was beyond the boundaries of all civilized behavior. So perhaps irritation was the mother of invention. It doesn't seem all that poetic, but there it is. In any case, a little door opened up in Dexter's dusty cranium, and a small light came shining out. A genuine piece of mental activity. Of course, Doakes might not think much of it, unless I could help him to see what a good idea it actually was. So I gave it a shot. I felt a little bit like Bugs Bunny, trying to talk Elmer Fudd into something lethal. But the man had it coming.
"Sergeant Doakes," I said, "Deborah is my only family,
and it is not right for you to question my commitment. Particularly, I said, and I had to fight the urge to buff my fingernails, bug style, since so far you haven't done doodly squat. Whatever else he was, cold killer and all, Sergeant Doakes was apparently still capable of feeling emotion. Perhaps that was the big difference between us, the reason he tried to keep his white hat so firmly cemented to his head and fight against what should have been his own side. In any case, I could see a surge of anger flicker across his face, and deep down inside there was an almost audible growl from his interior shadow. "Doodly squat," he said. "That's good, too." "Doodly squat," I said firmly. "Deborah and I have done all the legwork and taken all the risks, and you know it." For just a moment, his jaw muscles popped straight out, as if they were going to leap out of his face and strangle me. And the muted interior growl surged into a roar that echoed down to my dark passenger, which sat up and answered back. And we stood like that, our two giant shadows flexing and facing off invisibly in front of us. Quite possibly, there might have been ripped flesh and pools of blood in the street if a squad car hadn't chosen that moment to screech to a halt beside us and interrupt. A young cop jumped out, and Doakes reflectively took out his badge and held it toward them without looking away from me. He made a shooing motion with his other hand, and the cop backed off and stuck his head into the car to consult with his partner. "All right," Sergeant Doakes said to me. "You got something in mind?" It wasn't really perfect. Bugs Bunny would have made him think of it himself, but it was good enough. "As a matter of fact," I said, "I do have an idea. But it's a little risky."
"Uh-huh," he said.
"Thought it might be." "If it's too much for you, come up with something else," I said. "But I think it's all we can do." I could see him thinking it over. He knew I was baiting him, but there was just enough truth to what I had said, and enough pride or anger in him that he didn't care.
"Let's have it," he said at last.
"Oscar got away," I said.
"Looks like it."
"That only leaves one person we can be sure Dr. Danko might be interested in," I said, and I pointed right at his chest. "You." He didn't actually flinch, but something twitched on his forehead, and he forgot to breathe for a few seconds. Then he nodded slowly and took a deep breath.
"Slick motherfucker," he said.
"Yes, I am," I admitted, "but I'm right, too." Doakes picked up the scanner radio and moved it to one side so he could sit on the open back gate of the van.
"All right," he said.
"Keep talking." "First, I'm betting he'll get another scanner," I said, nodding at the one beside Doakes.
"Uh-huh."
"So if we know he's listening, we can let him hear what we want him to hear. Which is," I said with my very best smile, "who you are and where you are."
"And who am I?" he said,
and he didn't seem impressed by my smile.
"You were the guy who set him up to get taken by the Cubans," I said.
He studied me for a moment, then shook his head.
"You really put my pecker on the chopping block, huh?"
"Absolutely," I said. "But you're not worried, are you?"
"He got Kyle, no trouble."
"You'll know he's coming," I said. "Kyle didn't. Besides, aren't you supposed to be just a little bit better than Kyle at this kind of thing?"
It was shameless, totally transparent, but he went for it. "Yes, I am," he said.
"You're a good ass-kisser, too."
"No ass-kissing at all," I said. "Just the plain, simple truth."
Doakes looked at the scanner beside him. Then he looked up and away, over the freeway. The streetlights made an orange flare off a drop of sweat that rolled across his forehead and down into one eye. He wiped at it unconsciously, still staring away over I-95. He had been staring at me without blinking for so long that it was a little bit unsettling to be in his presence and have him look somewhere else. It was almost like being invisible.
All right, he said, as he looked back at me at last. And now the orange light was in his eyes. Let's do it.
Chapter 22. Sergeant Doakes drove me back to headquarters. It was a strange and unsettling experience to sit so close to him, and we found very little to say to each other. I caught myself studying his profile out of the corner of my eye. What went on in there? How could he be what I knew he was without actually doing something about it? Holding back from one of my playdates was setting my teeth on edge, and yet Doakes apparently didn't have any such trouble. Perhaps he had gotten it all out of his system in El Salvador. Did it feel any different to do it with the official blessings of the government? Or was it simply easier, not having to worry about being caught? I couldn't know, and I certainly couldn't see myself asking him. Just to underline the point, he came to a halt at a red light and turned to look at me. I pretended not to notice, staring straight ahead through the windshield, and he faced back around when the light changed to green. We drove right to the motor pool, and Doakes put me in the front seat of another Ford Taurus. "Give me 15 minutes," he said, nodding at the radio. "Then call me." Without another word, he got back into his car and drove away. Left to my own devices, I pondered the last few surprise-filled hours. Deborah in the hospital, me in league with Doakes, and my revelation about Cody during my near-death experience. Of course, I could be totally wrong about the boy. There might be some other explanation for his behavior at the mention of the missing pet, and the way he shoved the knife so eagerly into his fish could have been perfectly normal childish cruelty. But oddly enough, I found myself wanting it to be true. I wanted him to grow up to be like me. Mostly, I realized, because I wanted to shape him and place his tiny feet onto the hairy path. Was this what the human reproductive urge was like? A pointless and powerful desire to replicate wonderful, irreplaceable me, even when the me in question was a monster who truly had no right to live among humans? That would certainly explain how a great many of the monumentally unpleasant cretins I encountered every day came to be. Unlike them, however, I was perfectly aware that the world would be a better place without me in it. I simply cared more about my own feelings in the matter than whatever the world might think. But now, here I was, eager to spawn more of me, like Dracula creating a new vampire to stand beside him in the dark. I knew it was wrong, but what fun it would be. And what a total muttonhead I was being. Had my interval on Rita's sofa really turned my once mighty intellect into such a quivering heap of sentimental mush? How could I be thinking such absurdities? Why wasn't I trying to devise a plan to escape marriage instead? No wonder I couldn't get away from Doakes's cloying surveillance. I'd used up all my brain cells and was now running on empty. I glanced at my watch. 14 minutes of time wasted on absurd mental blather. It was close enough. I lifted the radio and called Doakes. "Sergeant Doakes, what's your 20? There was a pause, then a crackle. I'd rather not say just now. "Say again, Sergeant?" "I have been tracking a perp, and I'm afraid he made me." "What kind of perp?" There was a pause, as though Doakes was expecting me to do all the work and hadn't figured out what to say. "Guy from my army days. He got captured in El Salvador, and he might think it was my fault." Pause. "The guy is dangerous," he said. "Do you want backup?" "Not yet. I'm going to try to dodge him for now." 10-4, I said, feeling a little thrill at getting to say it at last. We repeated the basic message a few times more, just to be sure it would get through to Dr. Danko, and I got to say 10-4 each time.
When we called it a night around 1 a.m., I was exhilarated and fulfilled. Perhaps tomorrow I would try to work in, "That's a copy," and even, "Roger that."
At last, something to look forward to.
I found a squad car headed south and persuaded the cop driving to drop me at Rita's. I tiptoed over to my car, got in, and drove home. When I got back to my little bunk and saw it in a state of terrible disarray, I remembered that Deb should have been here, but was, instead, in the hospital. I would go to see her tomorrow. In the meantime, I'd had a memorable but exhausting day, chased into a pond by a serial limb barber, surviving a car crash only to be nearly drowned, losing a perfectly good shoe, and on top of all that, as if that wasn't bad enough, forced to buddy up with Sergeant Doakes. Poor, drained Dexter. No wonder I was so tired. I fell into bed and went to sleep at once. Early the next day, Doakes pulled his car in beside mine in the parking lot at headquarters. He got out carrying a nylon gym bag, which he set down on the hood of my car. "You brought your laundry?" I asked politely. Once again, my light-hearted good cheer went right by him. "If this works at all, either he gets me or I get him," he said. He zipped open the bag. "If I get him, it's over. If he gets me..." He took out a GPS receiver and placed it on the hood. "If he gets me, you're my backup." He showed me a few dazzling teeth. "Think how good that makes me feel." He took out a cell phone and placed it next to the GPS unit. "This is my insurance." I looked at the two small items on the hood of my car. They didn't seem particularly menacing to me, but perhaps I could throw one and then hit someone on the head with the other. "No bazooka?" I asked. "Don't need it. Just this," he said. He reached into the gym bag one more time. "And this," he said, holding out a small steno notebook, flipped open to the first page. It seemed to have a string of numbers and letters on it, and a cheap ballpoint was shoved through the spiral. "The pen is mightier than the sword," I said. "This one is," he said. "Top line is a phone number. Second line is an access code." "What am I accessing?" "You don't need to know," he said. "You just call it, punch in the code, and give them my cell phone number. They give you a GPS fix on my phone. You come get me." "It sounds simple," I said, wondering if it really was. "Even for you," he said. "Who will I be talking to?" Doakes just shook his head. "Somebody owes me a favor," he said, and pulled a handheld police radio out of the bag. "Now the easy part," he said. He handed me the radio and got back into his car. Now that we had clearly laid out the bait for Dr. Danko, step two was to get him to a specific place at the right time. And the happy coincidence of Vince Masuoka's party was too perfect to ignore. For the next few hours, we drove around the city in our separate cars and repeated the same message back and forth a couple of times, with subtle variations, just to be sure. We had also enlisted a couple of patrol units Doakes said just possibly might not fuck it up. I took that to be his understated wit, but the cops in question did not seem to get the joke, and, although they didn't actually tremble, they did seem to go a little overboard in anxiously assuring Sergeant Doakes that they would not, in fact, fuck it up. It was wonderful to be working with a man who could inspire such loyalty. Our little team spent the rest of the day pumping the airwaves full of chatter about my engagement party, giving directions to Vince's house and reminding people of the time. And just after lunch, our coup de grace. Sitting in the car in front of a Wendy's, I used the handheld radio and called Sergeant Doakes one last time for a carefully scripted conversation. "Sergeant Doakes, this is Dexter. Do you copy?"
"This is Doakes," he said after a slight pause.
"It would mean a lot to me if you could come to my engagement party tonight."
"I can't go anywhere," he said. "This guy is too dangerous."
"Just come for one drink. In and out," I wheedled.
"You saw what he did to Manny, and Manny was just a grunt. I'm the one gave this guy to some bad people. He gets his hands on me. What's he going to do to me?"
"I'm getting married, Sarge," I said. I liked the Marvel Comics flavor of calling him Sarge. That doesn't happen every day. And he's not going to try anything with all those cops around. There was a long, dramatic pause, in which I knew Doakes was counting to 7, just as we had written it down. Then the radio crackled again.
"All right," he said. "I'll come by around 9 o'clock.
"Thanks, Sarge," I said, thrilled to be able to say it again, and just to complete my happiness, I added, "This really means a lot to me. 10-4.
10-4, he said.
Somewhere in the city, I hoped that our little radio drama was playing out to our target audience. As he scrubbed up for his surgery, would he pause, cock his head, and listen? As his scanner crackled with the beautiful, mellow voice of Sergeant Doakes, perhaps he'd put down a bone saw, wipe his hands, and write the address on a scrap of paper. And then he would go happily back to work. On Kyle Chutsky? With the inner peace of a man with a job to do, and a full social calendar when he was done for the day. Just to be absolutely sure,